This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Corey Richens stood up at her sentencing and made a promise. She'd appeal no matter how long it takes. I don't know why I'm talking like Donna Adelson with her, but she kind of reminds me of a young up-and-coming Donna Adelson. If only she can be so lucky. She told her sons, "We're going to make this right." She called the conviction completely wrong, an absolute lie. Her defense attorneys told the judge they're filing a motion for a new trial and got the deadline extended from 14 days to 28. So now the question is whether any of that defiance is grounded in real legal ammunition, or whether this is a woman with a life sentence performing for an audience of three children who already asked the judge to lock her away forever. Joining us to help us break down this happy mother-son conversation, excuse me, Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. My goodness, Corey telling her boys she's going to fight this no matter how long it takes, and they're going to make this right. As somebody who's been on both sides of a courtroom, Eric, when you hear a defendant talk like that after the life without parole sentence is read and her kids are saying, "Please never contact us again," basically, is that ever rooted in a real legal strategy, or is this almost always, you know, the ramblings of a madwoman?
Well, Tony, basically, that's what they all say. They all are... Yeah. To, you know, sort of valiantly go against the system that has oppressed them and vindicate their rights. And some of them are right. Many of them are incorrect. At times there is significant legal basis to appeal. And we just saw Alec Murdoch, his case got his convictions got overturned. So it can happen. And there are grounds, but it can also be just sort of a statement you make that you think sounds good and you think is representing your interests, but has no chance.
So, Eric, I got some how you make the sausage kind of questions here, because I'm really curious about what's going on behind the scenes. What would go on behind the scenes first? Because, again, I don't know the legal system as well as you. When someone is going to do an appeal, is that going to be, or can it be an appointed defender, or is it going to be privately hired? Because I think that goes two different ways, right? About the depth, because I was thinking, it's like, who would want to defend her unless they're hired? I'm curious about that part of it. And then the other part too is, what does it look like when they meet with her? I mean, can you actually strategize with someone that is that kind of broken and thought processes is off? Or can you? I mean, I'm just kind of really curious about how would that happen that she could actually do this?
Yeah, Robin, good question. So when a person is sentenced to incarceration like this and they want to seek an appeal, typically they're appointed public defender at the appellate level who will analyze the case and file that appeal on their behalf. So she's probably going to get this legal assistance and not have to pay for it unless she hires somebody private. In terms of what making the sausage looks like, what you do is you get a copy of the whole trial transcript, and you know it's voluminous, it's tedious to pore over, and you have a whole legal team looking at this, indicating, hey, might this have been an error by the prosecution? Might this have been prosecutorial misconduct? Might this have been an erroneous ruling by the judge? These are flagging potential issues for the appeal that you then sort of construct, and then you go to your client. You say, hey, look, we've pored over everything. We think X, Y, and Z are at least potentially viable grounds for an appeal. This is what you should pursue. And then the client usually says, but the prosecutor was giving me dirty looks or whatever. And you say, hey, that's not a ground for appeal.
Thank you.
Going into this trial, I think we all kind of were looking at some of the things that were being presented, at least being pitched, I should say, out of the defense of Corey Richens' camp, and went, Yeah, I mean, there's some issues here with this investigation. I mean, it was not the greatest of investigations. Had it been done, I think, a little more thoroughly, a little more accurately, there wouldn't be so many questions, but it wasn't. So here we are. Prosecutors allegedly listened to jail calls between Corey and her attorneys. That's something they brought up. The Crozer recantation that the defense says wasn't disclosed in time. The walk the dog letter, publicity of it. I mean, some of these things, not saying that they're all valid arguments, but there are a lot of things that were being brought up. The denial of the motion to pull jurors from Salt Lake County. Is there anything here when you look at the issues that they have publicly said, we got problems with this? Is there anything that really feels like it has some obvious legs on appeal, or are all of these just kind of a lot of grandstanding and seeing what's going to stick?
Tony, you know, I think the most potentially colorable grounds for an appeal include any sort of discovery issues. So if this recantation was not disclosed in a prompt fashion in accordance with the law, appellate judges look at discovery issues. They want a fair playing field. And they want to say, hey, look, you know, prosecution, you guys had this procedural requirement to turn this stuff over, and you didn't do it by this deadline. That impaired the defense and their ability to assert their interest. That's one. Another one is, anytime prosecutors become privy to confidential and privileged communications between a client and their attorney, that is problematic. That can be a denial of due process. It can really be an issue of a constitutional quantum. However, I think the judge is going to look at those and cite to something called harmless error, which is essentially saying, hey, there may have been some problems, but they weren't so compelling that they would have been reasonably likely to lead to a different outcome. The prosecution already had the goods against you. I'm guessing that might be how those two issues are analyzed.
And I know Tony mentioned, you know, the type of investigation, how thorough it was, and the mistakes and missteps along that route that they took as a potential area that you didn't think, at least you didn't mention it right here, that it is. But also, I didn't see it as anything other than normal, because we really don't see that many perfect investigations. In your experience, was the way they conduct the investigation about par for the course, or was it a wobble outside the norm?
You know, I think it was within normal parameters, Robin. Like you said, you know, law enforcement, they're human, and they can't envision every possible development that could come in a case later on, such that they need to take some specific investigative action early on. You know, they're human beings, and I think that overall there was nothing glaringly egregious. In my opinion, may have been a misstep here and there, but I don't think that's going to win the day for Corey Richards.
Right.
How does the fact that Corey Richards didn't put on much of a defense other than during the prosecution's line of questioning and such, they called no witnesses, they rested right away, does that affect an appeals process, the fact that they didn't exercise anything when it became their turn to shine in that courtroom? I don't know the answer to that question. I do not, because we've seen so many cases where you have very vigorous defenses that are mounted and have some where it's just, you know, we're going to roll the dice and hope that not enough was revealed here to convict. How does that affect the appeal processes in any way, shape, or form?
Sure. So, you know, Tony, as you know, the Constitution holds that a defendant doesn't have to put on a case. They don't have to testify. They don't have to call witnesses. You know, should you? Depending on the case, yeah. But you don't have to. So a court is not going to hold those choices against her. However, depending on the nature of the grounds on which she appeals, you know, if she tries to attack some prosecution expert, a judge could say in their order, hey, you know, the defense had no burden to put on their own expert, but they could have. They had the opportunity. They could have challenged this evidence, but the evidence went unchallenged, and therefore the jury apparently found it compelling. So a judge kind of can consider it without expressly considering.
Yeah, I like it, because she really didn't try very hard, did she? Yet you're going to appeal it? I mean, when you look at Alex Murdaugh's defense and what they attempted to do and what this is like night and day difference.
Well, it's not always about did they try very hard. It's more so they viewed it as the defense or the prosecution didn't have enough. You know, and if the defense or the prosecution didn't have enough, why add more gasoline to the fire that could potentially get out of control? I think that's probably how they saw it, or they may have saw it as well, going, we don't really have that strong of a defense.
I think they're all deluded.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know exactly what their reasoning was, but they made their calculated move of choosing not to put on much of a defense. There was a lot of holes in the case, in terms of Corey's story, in my opinion, in terms of her innocence. One of the big ones that they kept pointing to early on was the recantation of Crozer, who was the individual who allegedly got the fentanyl, then gave it to the housekeeper, and then the housekeeper gave it to Corey, who then made the Moscow mules and the sandwiches and God knows whatever other recipe she, whipped up from TikTok that day and decided to add a little dash of fentanyl. Yeah, I mean, there's so many people in here that like think they might have been poisoned by Corey. It's becoming a club.
She could have helped us so much out if she just was a little lazier with how she did that. Boom, she's gone too.
All these, I think it's honestly, it's lucky more people didn't inadvertently die or that she didn't kill herself in the process. Damn, wouldn't that have been a shame? But that was a hole that they were pointing to. They're saying it was the prosecution's case. At the end of the day, let's say that there is some sort of argument to get Corey Richens another trial. The big pieces of evidence here. I mean, they laid all this out. They laid out the issues of Crozer, his confusion on what the drugs were. The jury heard it all, and they still were pretty able to connect the dots and go, yeah, we don't really care what you call it. At the end of the day, she asked for the Michael Jackson stuff, and you got her something that would do that job. You can call it rat poison if you want to. It doesn't really make a difference. It is what it is. It could have been propofol. It turned out to be fentanyl. And obviously, propofol wouldn't work in that form. But they're saying, obviously, this was the goal. It was accomplished. You can call it whatever the hell you want. At the end of the day, does it matter if she gets another trial? Because it's pretty much the same evidence. I don't see anything massively factual that would change or that wouldn't be admitted in a Corey Richens trial number two. Do you? Is there anything glaring here that you're like, well, if this were omitted, like in Murdaugh, financial crimes, if that were to be removed, is there anything here in Corey that if removed, you think would dramatically change this trial or has a chance at being removed?
Gosh, if by some miracle an appellate judge excluded the evidence from that Crozier guy who provided the drugs, excluded his testimony in some fashion, you'd probably throw a wrench in things. That would be problematic. But I just don't see a judge doing that. You know, there are witnesses have discrepancies, have inconsistencies. We're talking about an alleged drug dealer who's talking about drugs he provided to kill somebody. There might be slight variances in that testimony, but at the end of the day, the jury saw right through it, it seems. And in fact, they deliberated a very short period of time, is my understanding. It sounds like the prosecution has the goods. And even if we go to a round two, I just don't see a reasonable likelihood of a different outcome.
You know, I'm sorry. You know, I started playing in my mind. It's like, all right, let's play this thing out. And fast forward what she might be thinking in these moments. So here she is wanting to appeal, wants her freedom. And I get it. Everyone wants their freedom. But if you actually pragmatically and objectively think about it, like my crazy brain sometimes do, she can't survive on the outside of jail. She can't feed herself. She can't live anywhere. She's completely twice over bankrupted and no one wants her. What's she gonna do? I mean, I think her best choice is actually to stay in jail. I mean, it's the only place she can survive. I mean, what the hell? What would she do?
Yeah, sometimes the structure of those
I'm sorry, it's kind of stupid,
can actually be helpful.
she would find another unassuming man that she prey on, bamboozle, take advantage of, and just kind of keep black widowing it.
It all over again.
I mean, I don't know that she would necessarily kill. I mean, I don't know. I think anything's possible with this woman. But she, the thing is, there's strings of people like this, men and women, who just go from relationship to relationship and murder is never involved. But the damage that is done to the people that fall in these people's wake is incalculable.
You got to keep her away just because, and think about it. And we talked about this yesterday. you know, about what her mindset is. I doubt if she thinks in her own mind she killed. No, I'm just collecting life insurance policies. That's how that twisted mind kind of shifts that, you know, kind of like Lori Daybell Vallow. What a bunch of nutters.
Transactional. It's transactional.
It's only transactional.
Yeah. And the weight and the definition of words like love are not the same things that we view them as.
That was good.
Exactly. It's the you belong to me, all that. I'm not going to break into song today. But, you know, it is very different. Different definitions. It's a very different prism of looking at the world through. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to work our way through the Corey Richens case. Corey Richens spent 40 minutes at her sentencing talking to her sons, but buried inside the prosecution's sentencing memo was a different message that she'd sent to people outside. And the language is hard to read any other way. She wrote, "I will expose this county, the prosecution, the judge, the Richens, the investigation." She's out for everybody. She wrote, "They picked the wrong one." She wrote, "They haven't seen anything yet." Then
she's walking away.
Then she stood up in court and told her sons, "We're going to make this right. And don't give up on me." They already did. "This is the woman serving life without parole. She's not going anywhere, but her track record before sentencing includes an alleged letter instructing her brothers to testify falsely, accusations of witness intimidation, and a documented willingness to keep working the people around her from inside a jail cell." We're talking with Eric Faddis, defense attorney and former prosecutor, about this case, along with my co-host Robin Dreek, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis program. When prosecutors put that "they picked the wrong one" message into the setting, into the sentencing memo, I mean, it's not throwaway language here, you know, where she's coming at them. They picked the wrong one. I mean, when you look at this, when you look at the defendant sitting there putting on this show of "they picked the wrong one," threatening everybody around that she's coming for them, basically. I mean, what is it telling you of what is coming next realistically from the Corey Richens camp beyond just "we're going to appeal this"?
Well, Tony, the word "realistically," I don't think enters into Corey Richens' consciousness at all. I don't think she understands. Yeah. I think she is so delusional. And you sort of see that in her pattern of behavior. You know, writing a letter, the walk the dog letter, from the jail, she should have known that that's going to be reviewed by law enforcement. And did she just think she was so slick, they're not going to get it, and then it's going to be fine, and she can manipulate the system, and she's the one in charge, and now she's the one who's going to impose her wrath upon, you know, the prosecutors who were doing their job and convicted her handily. I think a judge looking at that is going to say, "Hey, this person is so detached and also potentially dangerous." It's a bit, has kind of an ominous tone. There's a threat to it. Not great for appeal, man.
You know, it's really interesting. So here's a, I know I'm going down these fun rabbit hole experiments that everyone can do on this case. I'm sorry. But if you want to really truly understand, I think, a part of her brain and what she's been able to get away with her entire life, do this. If you have the ability, go in and read the transcript without her saying it. It is the most horrendous, scary horror story you're going to read. So here's where I'm going with this. If you now cascade her delivery of it. Now listen to her delivering it. She's been able to rely her entire life, not on her words, but on her delivery. She looks, her presentation, all these things is how she's manipulated the world around her. But and that's why she's completely flummoxed, I think, by this whole system, besides her high-level psychopathy, is because law is based on words, not how you're presenting and delivering them. And so her words are what keeps sinking her in all these situations, because that is a complete horror story if you just read the transcript.
What kind of damage did she do any by that 40-minute speech to an appeal?
Yeah, you know, appellate judges are humans, man. And so, you know, they've got to go by the letter of the law, and they've got to not, you know, hold an unlikable personality against somebody, mm-hmm. on the one hand. On the other hand, they're human beings. So they're going to look at this and say, "Hey, there was not an ounce of remorse. There was There was nothing we would want to see from a person whom we might choose to release at some later time. And so, you know, would it shock me if an appellate judge looked at the case and in viewing the legal issues also had in the back of their mind, hey, this person's kind of a scumbag and they're probably pretty dangerous. And should that color the analysis? No. But does it? I think at times it does.
I mean, it feels like it pushed it over a line with the kids part, where the utter tone deaf to what she said after the kids had pled, please go away forever. Don't contact us. Just leave us alone. And she's like, we're going to make this right. I'm going to find you. I'm going to call you every day, whether you take my call. I mean, it was a threat to basically stalk them. I mean, for lack of a better term. Now, I want to put all that into a little bit of a context, though, because I think it's important, because I'm sure Corey wrote her speech before she heard what her kids were writing to her in that courtroom. Just as I'm sure all the people who sang Corey's praises had they basically pre-produced their own speeches, too, and their statements about Corey prior to hearing the litany of horror from her own children. And nobody in this courtroom was good at improv. nobody was like, I better throw that speech out because it makes me kind of look monstrous if I read this now after following the children. No, they just stayed to the script. And I think Corey stayed to the script. I'm guessing all those people pretty much stayed to their script. I'm wondering how many regret it now, looking back, going, maybe I should have just said, she's nifty. Good luck, Corey. Instead of going into how great she makes crock pot dinners and saving recipes, which I also found to be a bizarre thing to say at a trial trying to redeem someone for murdering their husband.
The judge is like, I don't care.
Donna Adelson's family just said the same crap about her, too.
Yeah, it's like those that pulled... Who was the one? Who had the enchiladas? Was that... That was Lori Daybell. Lori made the enchiladas, yeah. Remember? It's always like some reference to somebody's
Queen
shitty
Nutter
recipe.
Herself.
It's like, turns out you actually got them from on the border and put them in your own pan. But it's it's interesting to see the reactions that she got from people. But it does make me wonder a bit about... if she had a little more time to plan her reaction, if it would have been exactly that. I'm going to guess it probably would have, because I think Corey didn't necessarily hear anything those children said to her in those statements. I mean, does that weigh on, take Corey's reaction out of it, take her tone deaf everything out of it, does the victim impact statements from the family and especially from her own children, does that weigh anywhere in the appellate process with any judge in terms of deciding whether or not to retry someone? Again, I know they're human and maybe that's where it applies and maybe technically it shouldn't, but does any of that come into consideration when looking at this case?
By the letter of the law, Tony, it should have no bearing on an appellate analysis. The appellate analysis should be focused on, were there legal errors made by the government, so either the judge or the prosecution? Were those errors so weighty that they compel, under the law, a new trial? How a victim feels about an outcome of a trial or something, their time to express that is at the sentencing phase, but should not factor into the appellate analysis, could it? You know, of course, any human being could consider that, yes.
Another question on that is, Glenn, I know it's a real stretch. I know we're going down the real stretch road today, Eric, sorry. So her defense team, and everyone in the comments been saying the same thing, and we all been saying it, you know, they all drank the Corey Kool-Aid. And they were so, you could see the emotional investment they had in believing her as well as trying to defend her. Could that be considered by a new team coming in as ineffective counsel, that they might use that? Is that a possibility even?
In a sense, Robin, it could be, in the sense that if the first defense team was in such an echo chamber and they just they thought, hey, these three positions. These are going to win the day. These are what we need to assert. You know, let's not look at X. Let's not hire this expert. Let's instead, we've got it. We're on track, bro. And then they failed to, and then that sort of tunnel vision caused them to fail to consider something or to fail to take some action they should have taken. Sure, I think the new defense team could say, hey, look, this first defense team was so one-track minded on this, and they ignore these potential issues and these potential measures they could have taken to help her. So certainly second defense team could comment on that.
Yeah, I just thought about that just because they were so in bed with her. But at the same time, because of who she is as a psychopath, she would so quickly throw them under the bus and jump on the bandwagon. It's their fault because she can't take accountability for anything. She rationalizes and all her sycophants around her rationalize all these things away, like even the children's statements. I guarantee to you, not one person in her camp, including her, thinks her children wrote that. I guarantee it. They think it was implanted by the Richens family and the psychotherapists that were working with them. That's it. So I could easily see her throwing people under the bus saying she didn't have good counsel. Now, again, like you said, if that's going to have any weight or not, who knows?
And then surprise, you learn from the kids as they continue to grow older. No, it's exactly what they felt.
Oh, yeah.
And they were able to verbalize that in such a clear and concise way after reflecting on the monster that their mother is. If you were the attorney for the Richens family right now, or just a friend, just someone, you know, who knows the law, who's seen your share of folks go in and out of prisons and folks who get convicted that don't want to be convicted, and nobody really wants to be, but really have this kind of motor, this kind of denial of reality, this real messed up relationship with the truth. And you saw these threats that Corey is pitching out there in that courtroom of, you know, we're gonna figure this out. I'll be writing you or calling you every day, whether you take my calls or not. I mean, this sounds crazy. And we've already seen a track record of her using her flying monkeys, her supporters, her family members, who's ever still on her team, of using them to her advantage from behind bars, trying to poison the reputation of one of the investigators on a dating website, trying to there was a litany of things that were coming out of things she was trying to orchestrate behind bars in a real passive aggressive seventh grade 1997 sort of gotcha way. What would you be telling the Richens family right now, especially focusing on protecting those children from whatever bullshit she's going to try and pull from behind those bars? How can they right now, before she even gets to the game board and rolls her dice and starts moving her piece, what would you say to them to prevent her from even getting to that point of what you think she may try, what levers she may try and pull with the limited resources that she has?
I think you need to try and ensure that there is a responsible guardian in place. Look, the dad's dead, and the mom's going to be in prison forever, probably. And so you have to ensure that there is some point of contact and supervision and nurturing and things like that to the extent you can. And then from there, you talk about the risks. You talk about, hey, she's going to have a lot of time in prison. She's got a lot of time to make calls, to write letters, to request visits, things like that. And this person has been manipulative. They have been convicted of an extremely serious offense, and they could loop you in too to some kind of wrongdoing. Corey Richens, is it done? She's not going to sit with her, you know, sit on her hands in prison for the next 60 years. She's going to be reaching out to people, trying to make moves from behind those bars as she did while the case was pending. You got to be on your guard. You got to be vigilant, and you got to make sure that there is a responsible parent who is monitoring any type of contact like that. And if it gets harassing, if it gets problematic, there's protection orders. There are legal mechanisms to consider.
Are there any triggers inside the jail system itself that you're aware of, Eric, that, you know, when you have a situation like this, if you have an inmate that is being threatening external to the organization, that they pick up in either, because I know they read everything and coming in and out of that jail, is there anything that is a trigger that law enforcement does notify, you know, potential victims or potential targets of that, even though it's not directly involved in, but they're talking to these people over here?
You know, different jurisdictions and different facilities handle it differently, Robin, but some of them have victim notification systems whereby they say, hey, the parole date is coming up, or hey, this person could potentially be released by this time. But when it comes to specific communications, if there is anything that appears to be potentially criminal, it's usually either handled by the sheriff's department that runs the facility, or if it's a prison, it can be referred to local law enforcement. They might send, you know, send the communications, the emails, and say, hey, look, Corey is on the inside trying to finagle something shady on the outside. Y'all need to keep an eye on this, and maybe you should go talk to these folks with whom she's trying to be in contact.
Yeah, one more follow-up to that. So, again, I've never worked inside the jail system like this. Is part of the system, because I know it's public record and communication coming in and out, can the Richens lawyer, if they had a lawyer do this, can they routinely then request all the communications that she has in and out to kind of monitor on their own, or a PI of theirs or something like that?
Probably not. I think that Corey Richens probably has a very limited right to privacy in those. So the government can look at them, but I don't think any private citizen could just kind of want to, you know, could be seen as sort of sticking their nose in it. And I don't think that they would have a legal right.
You can FOIA request that stuff?
Yeah, I was thinking of a FOIA request.
You couldn't FOIA request that stuff? I mean, we've seen that happen. And for example, over in the Duggar case, we've seen a lot of FOIA requests that have received or gotten email communications between those imprisoned and family members and what they're talking about. Not obviously the attorney client communications, but like familial communications, things that don't necessarily have legal protections for confidentiality. I wonder if there's a lever there that could be pulled to keep their finger on the basically keeping your enemies closer, from the look of or from the parental responsibility angle of the family, which unfortunately they probably are going to have to take and stay super vigilant for the years to come.
That's a possibility. You know, that would be a creative usage of that. And I'm not sure. It could be one way to try to stay on top of that, because you can understand, Tony, why people on the outside, especially potential targets, potential victims, potential enemies, might want to be on top of this and saying, hey, is she talking about me? Is she, writing letters referencing me, stuff like that? And I could see why they'd want to know that, of course.
Yeah, so I just looked it up. So they could actually, and I hadn't heard of this. I guess you probably have, Eric, and that's a grandma request. Corey's publicly stated, so anyway, bottom line, the family can file a grandma request and should if they want documentation, but it's more effective to pursue formal no contact orders instead. But actually, they can file a request for those transcripts at some point.
What about preemptive no contact requests with Corey's family that are still in Team Corey, the flying monkeys, if you will? Because what my concern is here, I mean, they'll be blatant, people out there, and I'm sure there already have been people that are going to want to try and see the kids and have contact with the kids. And Eric's family hopefully is saying F off. But that may continue. And it's not that all these people have rights to go and see the kids, and they may have ulterior motives of get in there, basically implant yourself. Oh no, I'm not here about mom. I'm here just because I'm in this relation to them. And then slowly they start planting seeds of mom in there, and to prevent that from ever happening, getting ahead of it, orchiding the shit out of those weeds before they're able to get in. Now it's probably jurisdiction by jurisdiction, but correct me on that. Can you preemptively get a no contact order, even if there hasn't been necessarily attempts to contact that have been unwanted? Or does the lever have to be pulled? Does the action have to be taken? The unwanted communication have to be documented before a court will say, yeah, we can get you a no contact order here?
I don't think the victim's family could prevent a Corey Richens supporter from contacting them preemptively in that fashion. Okay. I think there would have to be some contact. I think there would have to be sort of harassing, annoying, vexatious in nature. Certainly threatening would qualify. But I think that there has to be some steps taken first. Now, the court can protect the Richens survivors from Corey because they're basically the victim. They're right. And they're the victim's kin. And so there can be protection orders imposed to prevent that kind of contact. But just like a fan of Corey trying to contact the family, it would have to get a little gnarly before a judge would say, hey, you got to stop them.
What if I know I was throwing a lot of, you know, random things out here, but I'm just trying to think of the crazy Thursday shit that like a narcissist would do without regards to rules or laws or the well-being of anybody they're asking them to do their dirty work for them. How about this one? Let's say, you know, Corey has already said, I will call you every day, whether you take my calls or not. Is there any mechanism? Because look, someone can, if you have a no contact order, great, but could she just keep sending letters from jail every day to her kids? I mean, would the jail stop them? Would the law stop those things from exiting the jail? Or is that up to the postal or any system? I mean, because even though they're like, see, we're gonna give you penalties because you're violating the no contact order. Yeah, and she's already spending her life in prison. She doesn't care about any sort of penalties you may impose. Is everybody just kind of at her
cups of soup?
You know, at the disposal of Corey Richens, who doesn't give a shit because there are no penalties that are going to trump what she already has.
It's an important point because, Tony, there are criminal laws that prevent harassment, that prevent repeated communication for no legitimate purpose that is annoying, harassing, and vexatious. But that's a misdemeanor, man. So that's if you're facing a life in prison sentence, what do you give a shit about an extra 6 months in jail tagged on there? It's meaningless. Now, however, if she did engage in such conduct, could the facility then limit her ability to write letters, to have phone calls?
Yeah.
It absolutely could.
Okay.
And I think that it should.
So there's a mechanism.
That would be the more effective mechanism, I think, is instead of the criminal laws, the facility saying, hey, we're taking away your privileges because you keep fucking that up.
Okay, so there is a mechanism that does exist. It's not just here's the rule and what we rely on is the penalty to prevent people from doing it. But if the penalty is meaningless, it doesn't matter to that person. But it's good to see that there's a mechanism. And one more on Corey. Are we just overthinking this at the end of the day? Does Corey even give a shit about her kids? This is the first time we've really heard her say anything about them to begin with. Not brought up in the trial. Not brought up. Oh, you're taking a mother away from her babies. None of that. I mean, that could have been an angle that was used and was not. Was that all just grandstanding for an audience to try and get sympathy at the end of the day? Do you think she actually is on a mission to communicate with her children? Does she have any reason? I think Corey's out for Corey and her freedom. And I don't know that her children have anything to do with making that a reality.
You know, someone in Corey's position might see it as a really good look to try to redeem their character by placing the focus on their children and saying, hey, I'm going to make this right for y'all. I'm your mom, and we're going to get through this all together and be one big happy family at some point down the road. And a person can present that way without having any sort of genuine feeling at all for those kiddos. It could be a complete strategy on behalf of Corey Richens, or it could be sincere feelings towards the kids too, I suppose. But just based on her history of manipulation, I think a lot of folks have some raised eyebrows about the sincerity of those expressions.
You know, it'd be interesting too. I agree. My conjecture on this is if she can fixate on a new narrative she can control more than the kids' narrative and being this mom, that she'll latch on to that if she's getting traction. So if someone came to her and said, hey, again, write a book, do a documentary, whatever stupid thing that someone's going to start playing into that ego, once she fixates on that where she can create another narrative because she's hitting brick walls in the other one, she might shift a lot quicker. Because again, as we said, and it's very clear, this wasn't ever about the kids. This was about her image as a human being that she wanted to present.
Eric, are there any laws preventing people from writing Corey Richens letters claiming to be from production companies or book companies saying, we're going to make a great book. We're going to turn you into a superstar, making her feel like she's the most special person on earth. And then eliciting responses out of her that may reveal interesting facts of the case. Is there laws preventing that? Is that illegal to do something of that nature?
It would depend a little bit on what the individual did with that information.
Published it on a podcast. Read the letters out loud on the air.
I've already written a few people you want on the show.
Is that illegal if I were to do exactly that?
Tony and I do funny things behind the scenes.
Certainly, investigators have a lot of discretion to procure information, including through artifice. And so, you know, I'm not aware of any laws that would expressly...
The only mistruth would be that I have no real intention of ever publishing a book or a documentary, but it's more so getting information from her to further expose her on our program. But under the context of a publisher.
Can you sue someone for defamation from behind bars?
Yeah, you can. And there's a tort, there's a civil tort, civil wrong called public disclosure of private facts. And if those private facts were obtained through misrepresentations, not saying you would do that, but there might be potential liability there. But there's free speech that goes into it too.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of moving parts to that, Tony. I'm going to have to get back to that.
Always looking for something new here. We really are.
Pen pal, you know? Who knows? Who knows what you might find.
I'm still waiting for one back from Ruby Frankie.
Yeah. I mean, well, you didn't say any of that. You just wanted to get her opinion. I mean,
Corey Richens.
I'm trying to figure what I need to do, Robin, to inspire her to speak. And that's...
You got to stand out from the noise. You know she's going to have a lot of noise. Yep. We talked about this off screen. You got to make the outside of that envelope. You have to make the content stand out from the typical riffraff and sycophants that are going to be emailing her and mailing her letters, because you know there's going to be a bunch. Most likely, she's going to read them all. The probability of responding is going to be slim to none unless you just tweak that grandiosity. It's the only thing that'll trigger her is grandiosity.
What if you pretended you were HGTV stars and you were writing as them to her? I mean, those people probably have more of a case against you for false impersonating them. But I'm thinking if you pretended you were Joanna Gaines writing Corey from in prison and like, oh my gosh, you inspired me, Corey, with that mansion, the Midway Mansion. Without you, we wouldn't have had Fixer Up. Some bullshit, you know. You were the inspiration for the silos, you know. Just some bullshit that makes her think, oh my god, because I think she's probably pretty easy to win over in that.
So if she's smart, which she's not, I'd imagine, and Eric, tell me this, is she in freak enough contact with the defense, you know, with a team or anyone of her legal counsel that she would then hand this off to actually do fact checking on for her? Or would she be on her own?
I doubt she's getting that kind of assistance at this juncture. And, you know, there's no tort for, hey, you tricked me. Like that in and of itself is not a legal claim.
Buyer beware.
Now, if there were damages and if there were false pretenses, maybe we're getting a little closer. But I think, you know, it might be fair game.
Tony, what I did on my writer,
what I did on my summer vacation. Interesting thought experiment right there. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. If only we had another 10 hours in the day to play with Corey Richen like cat and mouse. Let's go to another topic. Alec Murdaugh just got his convictions overturned, and instead of sitting back and waiting for a retrial, his defense team did something a lot of people didn't see coming. 5 days after the South Carolina Supreme Court ruled that Becky Hill placed her fingers on the scales of justice, Dick Harpootlian and Jim Griffin walked into a federal court in Charleston and sued her personally. A 17-page civil rights complaint, $600,000 in damages, and Griffin openly admitted at a press conference that the money isn't the point. The point is to peel back the onion of Becky Hill. Subpoena power, depositions, the ability to drag people under oath and ask questions the state's own investigators never bothered to ask. To bring this down legally, strategically, and in the bigger picture of the retrial, Eric Faddis is with us to help us have this discussion. Eric, let's start here and let's walk people through the 1983 lawsuit, what it actually is. This is usually a statute used against cops and prison guards. So why is Murdaugh using it against the clerk court, and what does the defense have to prove to win going at her in this lane?
Yeah, and Tony, I've got to say, I think we all called this, whereas a lot of people didn't see it coming, but on a prior show, we had discussed this possibility.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, here we are. So viewers need to tune in on that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, for a 1983 lawsuit, what we're talking about is when the government deprives a person of a constitutional right and causes them damages. So like you said, usually that's police. Usually it's police brutality. It's excessive force. Something like that. But here, Becky Hill's still the government. She's a court clerk, man. And so if she took actions that deprived Murdoch of the right to a fair trial, of the right to an impartial jury, of the right to due process, and that caused damages, the causation piece is a little more tricky, but he would have a valid claim, and he only has to prove it more likely than not that she deprived him of those rights and caused him damages. It's a lower standard on that civil side.
What are they? I don't want to use the word fishing expedition here because I don't think it is. I think it's more than that. I think it's a lake that's fully stocked and they know it. And they have a fishing license to go fishing. So it's not Scott Peterson out on a nice, you know, drift away Christmas Eve morning. I'm wondering, what is the goal here? Because there's a $600 that they're asking for, and they're saying it's not going to Alec. What is the goal here? Is this to get some sort of piece of information, of evidence that they can then use in the retrial, the criminal retrial of Alec Murdaugh? What do you see them looking at here? What are they searching for as the defense attorneys of Alec Murdaugh with this civil lawsuit?
You know, anytime you have a chance as a criminal defense attorney to ethically argue that your client has been railroaded by his own government, that can be a compelling argument. Mm-hmm. And we have the retrial coming up. And so now we have this intervening civil lawsuit in which Murdoch is saying, hey, the government violated my constitutional rights. And I think, as one of the commentators put it, I think he's got a good shot on that case. And so is he going to be able to somehow weave that case into the new trial to say, hey, look, I have been railroaded so badly by the government that this process is so patently unfair. You can't place any faith in it. You can't condemn this guy to prison for the rest of his life. And on top of that, the discovery process in the 1983 suit, perhaps they get some new information that they can use in the second trial. And perhaps there's a question as to, well, where did that information come from? Well, it came from a civil rights lawsuit that Alec Murdoch has against the government based on how they screwed him over before. So maybe they're angling in one or more of those directions.
A PR move more than anything else. I'm sorry. Go ahead,
Robin. Go ahead. So one of the things that I've been curious about as a potential defense on this, because having lived in the government for so long, you have nonstop mandatory training. As a matter of fact, one of the things they do if an agent is in a shooting is they go back and look at your firearms qualification record, and you have to have been up on all your training in order for the government to defend you. I mean, they'll always step in, obviously, but your culpability will come down to also your currency and training, the quality of that training. Is there any way that part of her defense, whether whole or just a part, she can point to the lack of good indoctrination or training in her position, especially since she was only in the position about 3 years from what I looked at and researched?
I don't think so. I don't think that's going to save her. I think,
good.
You know, and I think her defense might be in a 1983 lawsuit, you have to show a violation of a clearly established right. And so, of course, there's a right to a fair trial. But is a court clerk saying, you know, keep an eye on the defendant or don't be tricked by the defense? Is that a clear violation of a constitutional right, or is there some gray area there? Even in the appellate ruling, you know, I don't know that they come out and expressly conclude that there was a violation of certain constitutional rights. Although I take that back. They might have, and so that might actually be even more helpful for Alec Murdoch in that, and you know, her ignorance what's the word I'm looking for? Just carelessness and how she handled that and lack of training because of that is not going to be a defense.
Peeling back the onion is going to be interesting because you have the statements that were made. You also have Egg Lady, which is a big deal. She wrote a book too. And Egg Lady is the other juror that was kicked off, who had been there for most of the trial. And then at the last minute, Becky gets her kicked off by basically presenting what amounts to, in my opinion, lies to the judge, stating that her ex-husband posted this thing on a forum about talking with his ex-wife about the case. Turns out none of that was true. Turns out these posts were never actually made. But it was enough to get the judge to say, okay, we're going to remove you for said thing that never had. They never investigated it on the fly. I don't know if they really could have adequately investigated it on that fly as well either. So I'm not faulting the judge for kicking her off out of precaution. You have your alternate jurors. Okay. But it certainly shows that there was some motivation there to get rid of this juror that truly has said that they were on the fence about Alec Murdaugh and that she is the catalyst that pushed them away. The question being, and I know Griffin brought it up, or Harpootle, and one of them did in the press conference the other day, of was Becky Hill acting alone? Was she a lone wolf? She might have been, just because she basically offed two jurors figuratively from this trial doesn't necessarily mean, or at least one juror, doesn't necessarily mean that there's multiple people working as a conspiracy against Alec Murdaugh. But there's a lot of weirdness in this case. There's a lot of weirdness wondering, did Alec act alone? And if he didn't, if he knew something, where do you think they're going with this, with going after Becky? Do you think they're going to find that there was other people involved that had an interest in getting Alec convicted and maybe also put their fingers on the scales of justice? But does it lead anywhere further than just someone's misguided ambition for justice and what they view as justice? Or do you think that maybe there's more here? Or again, all PR makes it look a lot worse than it actually is.
Well, Tony, I can only speculate. I don't know.
Yeah.
But in terms of conjecture, you know, if you think prosecutors and the police don't have an interest in securing convictions, you're mistaken. The public's mistaken if they believe that. Because although a prosecutor's duty is to seek justice and not just convictions, that's in our ethical code, actually. You better believe that they care about the outcomes of these cases, and they have resources, and they have connections, and they have access, and they have abilities that the normal person doesn't have. And have we seen prior corruption in cases like this? Trying to go after somebody unjustly or bending the rules to try to put their finger on the scales of justice, as the court expressly indicated in the Murdaugh appellate order, those things can happen. And if there was something there, then in the retrial, Murdaugh can be like, hey, there is a conspiracy against me. My government is biased against me. They are willing to go to these underhanded measures in what amounts to criminal jury tampering. Becky Hill should be in jail. And look, it's not only Becky Hill. If they're able to find something else, I think that could get some traction in the second trial to be like, hey, there is a consortium of governmental officials who are here to lock me up, regardless of whether I did it or not. This process is patently unfair. You cannot place faith in it. You cannot convict.
It's interesting. There's two different theories on it. I'm more of the simpler explanation on it. I think Becky's attempt in getting people kicked off that jury was probably most likely tied to her greed for making that book and trying to get goodwill from the judge, because she's trying to create a halo around herself, from my perspective. She's trying to create a halo like, you can trust me because look at, I'm so vested in doing the right thing here, so that don't look at my book over here. So I'm more of the halo end of that, but because I would think we'd get more leakage, you know, if anyone else was involved, you know, prosecutors, you know, other people, because it wouldn't be anyone on an investigative team or prosecutorial team. It wouldn't be their first rodeo of having done this, because, again, the great ethical code you guys are sworn to. So I think at some point along their careers, or at some point, people would be looking at that and be able to expose it before now.
Yeah, and clearly that would be the remote exception and not the general rule. The general rule is that those folks are just out there seeking justice.
I just think she's greedy.
Yeah.
So if I'm reading the tea leaves right, tell me from your perspective as an attorney, Eric, it seems like there's two areas that the Murdaugh defense are going after. One is the reasonable doubt area, obviously. But if you're not going to have the cornucopia of financial crimes being able to be brought in, what do you replace that with? Let's go to the actual architecture of what happened here. Let's focus on the corruption of the system. Let's get that brought in as its replacement substitute, if you will, since that's no longer on the menu. And the timeline. We've already seen Griffin or Harpootle in one of them. I remember somebody was saying the other day at the press conference talking about the way that they identified time of death and identified the bodies by sticking sticking his hand under the arm and saying, okay, this is when it happened. It wasn't done scientifically. It wasn't done with a thermometer. It wasn't done anally. It wasn't, I mean, these were things were actually brought up. So I'm going to guess they're going to be questioning timeline here, because the big question is going to be, if Alec had nothing to do with it, then why is he on the video at the kennels? And these people were killed like within minutes of that video. They're, from what it sounds like, they're going to try and point, well, it wouldn't have to have been within minutes of that video. It could have been hours. They didn't actually test for time. And a long time occurred between that video and when the police were actually called. A lot of time passed there. And if Alec had just been down there and the dog was barking and then he went to go see his mom, they got killed right after that, right after he left. Maybe they saw him leave the property and thought, okay, it's time for us to come in and do our work. I'm guessing this is going to be what we're going to hear in Alec Murdaugh trial number two. Your thoughts?
Totally with you on that. And at least in my experience, usually coroners and medical examiners cannot pinpoint the minute that a person died. Usually, oftentimes, cannot pinpoint the hour at which a person died. And using some sort of, just putting your hand on them, oh, they feel kind of cold. It must have been 7:36 p.m. That's ridiculous. So I think they're going to attack it on those grounds. And then also the sort of larger governmental corruption thing going against the big head honcho in the small town. They want to take him out, and they didn't have an alternative suspect, so it had to be this dude. They foregone conclusion, things like that. I think we're going to see a lot of fireworks in the second trial and things we might not have seen in the first.
They're going to have to compete, though, on that argument, though, with the not-so-scientific death timing that the coroner looked at using his hand, with the digital timing, with the phones both going silent about the same time and not moving for a period of time. Although there's some argument there too about how SLED processed the devices and when they were last accessed. So they got some of that to hang their hats on. It's a lot of pieces that have some meat on the bone, but it's not a full piece of meat where it's like, but if you can just satisfy the jurors enough that they got something in their snack box, maybe they will say, you know what? We did get fed here, and he's a free man. I don't know where I come up with these bizarre analogies. I feel like sometimes I summon the ghost of Dan Rather, even though he's not dead.
Those little pieces of meat can make for a really good stew at the end of the day.
Exactly.
So we'll have to see if that's the direction it goes.
That's going to be fascinating. Give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. And let's weigh in. We'll continue that conversation in the comment section. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you so much for being here. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent. And his latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books. Go and get it right now. Until next time, for Eric, for Robin, for Todd, I'm Tony. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.